Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Men are haunted by the vastness of eternity. And so we ask ourselves, will our actions echo across the centuries? It's a great question, worthy of an entire episode of The Rest is History. But who said it? Napoleon? Abraham Lincoln? Winston Churchill? No, it was Sean Bean, playing Odysseus, admittedly, in the 2004 film Troy. Not the most obvious casting, I'd have thought. Anyway, Troy is the subject of our discussion today. And with me is the Brixton Achilles, Tom Holland. And after last week's discussion of 1981, this is a bit of an away fixture for me and a home match for Tom. We're on your natural terrain, aren't we?
Yes, we are. The fans are gathering in the stands.
So the peg for this is the all-conquering Leviathan that is Stephen Fry has a new book out on Troy, which tells you everything you need to know about the fascination with it. But a personal peg for me is that I'm currently reading my son. His bedtime reading is a children's version of the Iliad, which he is loving, actually.
And I would add that I'm actually right in the middle of writing a sequel to the Trojan War, which is a history of ancient Greece for children, in which the gods continue to play lead roles. So you still get Zeus and Athena and everything. So coming to a bookshop next summer, folks. So
the stars are aligned.
The stars are aligned. Absolutely. But before we do that, let's just read some comments that we've had about previous shows. And Jamie Kingston got in touch after last week's episode. Loving this podcast. That's very much the kind of feedback we like. It's already become a favourite of mine. Great. In this episode, I can't remember which one. Oh, this is 1981, of course. In this episode, we learned that Dominic hates weddings and royal weddings. Well, royal weddings in particular, isn't it?
I don't like weddings.
Oh, full stop. Okay. Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm just a bit of a misery, you know. Eeyore, somebody said on Twitter.
Yes, okay. Well,
not wrongly.
We learned that Tom wasn't born with a cricket bat in his hand. Again, that's true. And Ian Botham is actually a Victorian.
Is he a Victorian or is he more... I think he's more 18th century.
Yes, I guess. Yes, probably. Yeah.
He's kind of breeches rather than, you know, trousers.
Yes, yeah. And then he's also, of course, very 1980s, which was the discussion of last week's podcast.
So Stuart Scott said, I'd take 1981 over 2020 at the drop of a hat. I guess probably quite a lot of people would agree with that, though perhaps not in Toxteth.
Or indeed in Brixton, where I live. One of the principal characters of 1981 was, of course, Margaret Thatcher, who we described as highly divisive. I mean, I think that's kind of written into the... That's a rule, isn't it? You can't mention Margaret Thatcher without saying highly divisive.
Controversial Prime Minister.
This prompted an interesting question from someone who calls himself or herself or itself Wrecked on Twitter. And he, she or it asks... Can you name the last undivisive prime minister? That's a good question. I mean, prime ministers are divisive by their very nature, aren't they?
Yes, because to govern is to choose, and to choose between two different camps. But I suppose so there are prime ministers whose stock in trade is to be emollient, aren't there? David Cameron, let's say, Tony Blair before Iraq. Was Harold Wilson that divisive? Was Jim Callaghan? I'm not convinced they were, really. And none of the 50s prime ministers were particularly divisive.
I suppose what's distinctive about Mrs. Thatcher is that being divisive was part of her self-image, that she kind of revelled in it, whereas most prime ministers tend not to.
Exactly. If she thought if you were not being divisive, that showed you had no guts, you weren't in the arena.
Tories talk about being one nation conservatives, don't they?
They do.
Which basically...
And they bash Labour politicians. They say they're class warriors. They're fomenting class war and all this kind of thing. So they sort of part of the Tory message is often to say there is no division, actually, and we should all just be one happy family.
And vote Tory.
Sort of Stanley Baldwin.
Yes, yeah. Okay, well, that's. I knew you'd have a good answer for that. Anyway, I think that's enough of modern history. Can we get to a far more interesting topic? Namely, the Bronze Age.
Great, yes. So, looking at the publicity for Stephen Fry's new book, there's one line in particular: "Enter the world of Troy and the most legendary story ever told." Well, is it the most legendary story ever told? I suppose it is, Tom Holland. That's quite a claim, isn't it? But tell us, okay, so for the modernists among us, tell us in no more than about 40 words the entire story of the Trojan War.
Okay, the world's most beautiful woman, the daughter of Zeus, Helen, is abducted by a Trojan prince called Paris to the city of Troy. All the Greeks have sworn an oath that if Helen gets stolen by anyone, they will go and get her back. So the heroes of Greece are kind of duty-bound to sail to Troy. They camp in front of the walls of Troy for 10 years. Terrible and heroic deeds are done. Great heroes fight, great heroes die. At the end, the only way that the Greeks can get into Troy is to play a trick. They build a huge wooden horse. They leave it supposedly as an offering to Poseidon, the god of the sea. In fact, the Greeks have hidden their best warriors inside the belly of the horse. The Trojans rather stupidly take the horse inside Troy. The Greeks come out. They burn Troy. They all go home.
Great. Wow, Tom. You're very good at these little summaries, I think. Thank you. The history doesn't work out, you can always... so this is the question, isn't it? Did it actually happen? And give us a year. Pin yourself down to a year or at least a century.
Well, Greek historians gave various dates and they would range by our dating system from kind of 1250 to 1150 BC. That's the end of the Bronze Age. And the huge question is, when the Greeks wrote about the Trojan War, and I suppose specifically Homer, who's the great poet who everybody else who writes about the Trojan War stands in his shadow, were they drawing on authentic memories of something that actually happened? And there have been various opinions about that over the course of time. The Greeks and the Romans were fairly convinced that it had happened. They gave various accounts of it, various versions of it. There was no kind of definitive version, although Homer was kind of as close to definitive as they got. By the beginning of the 19th century, people were coming to assume that it was a fairy tale, that it had no roots in fact at all. And then the German businessman turned archaeologist Heinrich Schliemann famously decided that he was going to prove it had happened. And using Homer, he went to what's now kind of the north of Turkey.
Yeah, so where are we? Let me interrupt you, Tom. Where are we exactly? Is this a sort of round about Gallipoli, am I right?
Yeah, so it's by Gallipoli. So you think of the Aegean separating Greece and what's now Turkey. You think of the narrow strip of water that separates Europe from Asia and leads into the Black Sea. Troy commands the entrance to those straits. So you can see that it would, you know, it's strategically significant. Schliemann goes there, he digs it up, supposedly. I mean, and when we say dig it up, I mean, he really digs it up. He digs a massive great trench and demolishes vast swathes of the archaeology and discovers what he claims to have been Homer's Troy. And I guess the consensus of archaeologists now would be that this is the site. It's a hill called Hissalik. Probably was Troy. And we know that this is where the Greeks and the Romans thought that the battle had been fought, because in the wake of Alexander's conquest, a town grows up there, which is a kind of homage to the original Troy.
Well, they definitely thought it happened, didn't they? Because I've just been writing a children's book about Alexander the Great, and there's a great moment in it when they pitch up the Macedonians, they're invading Persia, and Alexander makes a special trip to Troy, to what he thinks is the tomb of Achilles. And he does what we all do when we visit the graves of our ancestors. He takes all his clothes off, anoints himself in oil, yes, and then runs round and round the tomb.
Yeah, it's classic behaviour on a Turkish trip. We've all done it.
Yeah,
and before that, when Alexander says that he is invading Asia to get revenge for the Persians who had invaded Greece back in 490 and 480 BC. And that had been led by Xerxes, the king of Persia. And Xerxes, when he led his invasion, he went to the site of Troy and paid his respects to the heroes. I mean, this was kind of good PR. And this sense that the Trojan War is a kind of decisive moment in an ongoing war between East and West, between Asia and Europe, is very much a theme that the Greeks pick up on. And it's elaborated by Herodotus, who is the first great historian. Translated by me, folks. Again, rush out and buy if you haven't yet. Just getting that, slipping that one in.
Quality plug.
So Herodotus rationalizes the abduction of Helen as basically being something not very important. And his take is that the Greeks massively overreact. I mean, Herodotus basically says, we've all stolen a princess or two. I mean, it's ridiculous, it's ridiculous to overreact.
So it's almost like a bit sort of a false flag operation or something.
I think Herodotus, you know, he begins his history. So this is the first passage of prose of any work of history ever written. And it's about how people in Asia and people in Greece are constantly stealing each other's princesses. And Herodotus,
and he really thought this happened.
Yeah, he thinks it happened. He thinks it happened. And also, interestingly, Thucydides, who is the next great historian, follows after Herodotus, who's famously sceptical. He also thinks it happens, but he provides the kind of rationalist perspective on it. And he says that he doesn't think that it was about Helen at all. He thinks that it was about wealth, and that Agamemnon, who is the leading king, the king of Mycenae, the richest city, and who is kind of commander in chief at Troy, that he was so powerful that he could get all the various Greek kings together and lead a common expedition. And Thucydides thinks that this is all about kind of controlling trade routes and stuff.
Oh my God, he's a Marxist. He thinks it's all about the search for profit.
His perspective is very much that of a strategist, someone who doesn't have much place for fantastical tales of abducted princesses. Yeah. And I guess that's probably the perspective that that many modern historians would have as well. That this is a war that's happening in the context of great power politics and attempts to control trade routes and things like that. It's not about beautiful princesses being abducted.
Of course. So the temptation is to see it as Europe versus Asia, isn't it? But my sense is that would be completely wrong, because isn't this just generally the Greek-speaking world? Isn't Troy... What would Troy have been? Would it have been a Greek-speaking city, a Hittite city? So the Hittites are the people in Anatolia, aren't they?
Right.
I mean, what is it?
Yeah, so the Hittites are a key part of trying to understand what the actual Trojan War might have been. And the Hittites rule an empire across what's now Turkey, Anatolia. And at the beginning of the 20th century, a kind of cache of royal correspondence was found. And so over the course of the 20th century, these have been deciphered. And there are a couple of letters that cast potential light on the Trojan War. So one of them mentions a town called Willusa. And
sounds just like Troy.
well, but another name for Troy was Ilium. So you can see that there's potentially a kind of bleed there from Willusa perhaps to Ilium. And what's also interesting is that the king of Willusa is a man called Alexandu. And an alternative name for Paris, the prince who abducts Helen, is Alexander. So you know, maybe there's a mesh there. And the other letter is a letter addressed to the king of a land called Ahiwawa.
And gosh, you said that very nicely.
My Hittite is fluent. And Ahiwawa sounds, again, a bit like Achaea. And Achaeans is what Homer, writing in perhaps the second half of the 8th century BC, calls the Greeks. So perhaps the Achaeans, the Achaeoi, which Homer is using, is a trace element of Ahiwawa. But the key thing about this is that nobody really would care about this very obscure kind of Bronze Age diplomacy war, whatever, were it not for the fact that Homer had written this amazing poetry.
Yeah.
And that poetry has then kind of descended down through the centuries. So your son, you know, you're reading it to your son.
Yeah.
What is it about the Trojan War. Presumably, I mean, he's not interested in, you know, trade routes through the Hellespont.
No, he loves the Hittites. He's really into the Hittites. No, you're right. I think it's the... What is it? That's a very good question. I think... I mean, obviously, with the Iliad, it's the personalities, isn't it? And it's the... And it's the slightly unexpected, I mean, to a modern sensibility, it's a very unexpected story. So Achilles, their great hero, spends half the time sulking in his tent and refusing to come out. There's a sort of incongruity. There's this odd disconnect between the sort of heroic status of the characters, and often they're quite too apt to modernise Weasley behaviour, which I think is intriguing.
Yeah, I mean, an interesting thing about it is that if you look at the Iliad, which is Homer's account of the Trojan War, there's not actually very much about the Trojan War there. It's a very short space of time. So lots of the most famous things, so like the Trojan Horse is not in the Iliad.
And the Trojan Horse is a great story, isn't it? I mean, the Trojan Horse is this, I mean, clearly this sort of, this mythic sort of, this dissection of hubris, this moment of great craftiness, this sort of plot by the Greeks, this sort of heist, effectively, yeah. that comes off.
Well, I mean, it always seemed to me a ridiculous plot. You're Trojans, you've been suffering a siege for 10 years, the Greeks go, and there's a huge great horse. You're going to have a bit of suspicion, aren't you?
Are you? I mean, you know, there's actually a wooden horse at the site of ancient Troy. So the Turkish authorities have built a wooden horse, and it sits there outside their site. It doesn't look great, to be honest. It's not terribly impressive.
How many do you think it would fit in?
7? I don't know, 10?
That would be enough, wouldn't it?
But they just needed to open the gates, right? They don't need to storm the whole city. Don't they just get in and open the gates? Isn't that how it works?
Yeah, they open the gates, but there are enough of them to start the slaughtering and the pillaging.
I mean, you wouldn't do that with 7 people, would you?
No, you need more than that. It's got to be quite a big horse. Listen... Let's take some questions, because questions about the Trojan War have a very, very long pedigree. The Emperor Tiberius, when he was retired on Capri, used to hold the equivalent of a pub quiz for his
guests. The Trojan War?
Yeah, and he would ask some kind of difficult questions like, so Achilles, the great hero, when he was a boy, was disguised as a girl. And Tiberius would say, what name did Achilles have as a girl? And wow. Odysseus, the cunning hero who... comes up with the idea of the Trojan War. He has a very, very long voyage back home, and he sails past sinister creatures called the Sirens, who sing beautifully and then devour the sailors who are lured to their island. And Tiberius wanted to know what the song was that the Sirens sung.
Wow. And he would expect people to know this. And would they know it?
Well, he would. And there was one of his guests who cheated and got hold of the questions before they were asked. So what do you think Tiberius did to him?
Threw him off the rock.
Had him killed. Don't cheat if you go to a pub quiz run by a Caesar. Anyway, let's come back to the questions that we've been asked.
But Tom, I think we should take a break first.
Before we take the break, I'm going to read you Carl Johans or Johans' question. And you can have a ponder, because I'm going to put you have to answer this. What war or event, he asks, comes closest to being of similar significance to the modern West as Troy was to the Greeks? Good question. Let's have a break.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Rest is History. So just before the break, Tom asked me Carl Johan's question, which is what war comes close to being of similar significance to the modern West as Troy was to the Greeks? So it seems to me, Tom, that the obvious answer to that is, I mean, the blatantly obvious answer is World War II. I mean, World War II is the event that sort of lingers in the Western psyche as the ultimate symbol of man's humanity to man. It's the ultimate morality tale. We structure the way we think about the world around the evil of the Nazis, the heroism of standing up to them, the dangers of appeasement, all that kind of stuff. Don't you think that the Second World War is basically our mythic story?
I think on the level of myth, but I think there's also a seasoning of the First World War, because the thing about the Trojan War is that it's pointless. So if you think of the myth of the First World War is that it's, you know, what was it all for? It was all fought in vain.
Yeah.
People slaughtering each other.
Blood
in
and
mud.
Poppycock.
That's pretty much what the Trojan War is. I mean, it's ruinous and it's destructive and nothing really comes of it.
But hold on, the Greeks didn't think about it that way, didn't they? Didn't they find it heroic and inspiring? I mean, when Alexander runs around the tomb of Achilles naked, he's not thinking, he's not thinking, oh, this was a complete waste of time and this is the sort of Douglas Haig of the Bronze Age.
Well, Achilles becomes a great hero because he chooses a short life and eternal fame over a long life and obscurity. But
So he's like Rupert Brooke or something.
Yeah, but in the sequel, The Odyssey, we meet the ghost of Achilles in the underworld, and he says it's terrible. I made a terrible mistake. I'd much rather be a kind of slave working the land than be a king in the underworld. And if you look at the Greek tragedians, the Athenian tragedians, and Aeschylus, one of them, said that basically Greek tragedy is just kind of cuts from the great feast of Homer. They are incredibly bleak. The tragic world, the way in which terrible things happen for and don't really serve a purpose, is absolutely a kind of riff on the idea of the Trojan War as being kind of agonizingly pointless. And
yeah.
I think that, you know, if you fuse the First World War with the Second World War, the mix of that would give you something approximating it.
Now, the producer has been pestering me with questions while you've been talking. Not that he wasn't listening to you, Tom, but he's just been texting me with questions about Helen of Troy. Was this just a fight about a beautiful woman? Tell us about the woman, all this kind of stuff. So, yes, that's interesting, isn't it, that it's all about a woman. I mean, there aren't many real wars that are either generated by women or that have women at their sort of absolute centre, as this does.
Well, I think, again, to go back to Herodotus, the history begins with an account of different people raping each other, raping each other's women. I think there is a kind of, to a disturbing degree, there is a sense that the history of war is also the history of rape. So to that extent, there is a kind of, you know, a dark truth to the story of Helen's abduction. But, you know, in the kind of the more romantic sense of it, we do actually have a very good question from Julian Lennox, who says, speaking of Helen, who are other historically beautiful people, specifically people whose beauty had historical significance, as in it changed the course of history? So, you know, are there women whose beauty was such that it changed the course of history? What do you think?
I think that's a great question. He actually said people, Tommy, didn't say women.
Yeah, he did. So I'm being sexist.
You've revealed
there. Yes,
your
yes,
own.
Yes, I'm
shocking.
Being sexist there. Yes.
That's the male gaze in action, isn't it?
Yes,
that's,
it is.
This is a terrible moment. I think your cancellation is surely only moments away. It's an interesting one. Is it women or is it sexiness? Because sexiness obviously does matter. And the example I always think of is Anne Boleyn.
Oh, good one. Yes.
So the funny thing about Anne Boleyn is she's not conventionally attractive. People at the time, all these sort of ambassadors at the Tudor court would write back and they would say, oh, she's sallow-faced, she's sort of vulpine, you know, she's not attractive.
She had 11 fingers, didn't she?
But she, well, there was this claim about the finger as well. I think we should probably, gloss over that.
Was that okay?
Yeah, maybe it was. Maybe she was able to put this extra finger to very potent use. Who knows?
Dominic.
So Anne Boleyn has this hold over Henry VIII, clearly, and he's obsessed with her. And, you know, had it not been for that, and by the fact that she was, you know, interested in the kind of new evangelical ideas, the new kind of ideas critical of the Catholic Church, it is perfectly plausible that England, you know, there would have been a Protestant movement, but the king would have fought it off and that England would have remained a Catholic country, as France did. So you can say with somebody like Anne Boleyn, one individual's sexual allure does hold the key to a massive structural cultural change.
So she's the face that launched 1,000 monasteries being dissolved.
1,000 Bibles.
Yeah. 1,000 Bibles.
What about Cleopatra? Cleopatra is not very...
Well, yes. I mean, Cleopatra is, of course, is always presumed to have been incredibly beautiful.
But not beautiful,
and a great
right?
Well, if you look at her coins, she doesn't look particularly beautiful. And I think that sex wasn't necessarily what she was offering the men she slept with. Because basically, we only know that she slept with two men, Julius Caesar and Mark Antony. And both of those men happened to be the most powerful men in the Mediterranean at the time. So I think we can, you know, and even when Antony dies, Cleopatra then makes a pitch at Octavian, who will the future Augustus.
So if Melania Trump moves on to Joe Biden, we'll know that she wasn't interested in Donald for his looks.
Yes, I think that would be a reasonable presumption. But of course, in the way that Cleopatra is portrayed as a kind of fatal seductress, there is something there of Helen, the idea that the love of a beautiful woman can be destructive for heroes and indeed for cities. Yeah. So, yeah, that's absolutely part of it. Now, do we have... we have lots more questions, don't we? Give me another question.
What about Josh Harold Wilson? I wonder if there's any relation to... But Josh Harold Wilson says, is film a useful tool for exploring history, or does it do more damage than good? Well, that's very topical with The Crown, isn't it? So the film of Troy, you've seen the film of Troy, the Brad Pitt film?
It's the worst film about the ancient world ever made.
That's a big claim. Worse than Cleopatra?
Cleopatra's great.
Oh, it's very long, though. Very, very boring, as I remember.
No. Troy is the worst film ever made because it gets rid of the gods and therefore it gets rid of everything that makes Homer interesting, because without the gods, it becomes quite dull. And more than that, what they're trying to do with Troy is to make it historically grounded. And the whole point is that whatever you may think about the kind of the tiny acorn of fact that gives rise to the great oak of the Trojan myth, it didn't happen. It didn't happen as Homer portrays it. There was no Achilles. Yeah. There was no Helen. There was no Trojan horse. So it's all myth. So the very attempt to try and portray it as though it did is a spectacular waste of energy and effort. It's truly terrible. But does it do any harm? I don't think so. I don't think it does any damage.
Probably, I suppose you can argue that films as propaganda do harm, don't they? I mean, they enter into the collective imagination of people, and if what they are promoting is, you know, difference, hatred, all this sort of stuff.
Well, an interesting counterpoint would be 300, which is also a film about ancient Greece and tells the story of the Spartans at Thermopylae. And that, I think, is a brilliant portrayal of the ancient world, because it very accurately portrays the Spartans as proto-Nazis, as proto-fascists, which is basically what they were. The Spartans were a huge inspiration to the Nazis. And one of the things that's unsettling about 300 is that it doesn't serve up the kind of morality that we expect. The strong are strong, the weak are weak, and the weak are contemptible for being weak. And it's very unsettling, but I think also very, very accurate. But there's a reason, you know, 300 has become very popular with the kind of more right-wing fringes for that reason. So it could be argued that's done damage.
That is interesting, isn't it? Let's talk a bit about, since we've got onto 300 and all this stuff, about how we see the Trojan War, how modern societies have seen the Trojan. So something that's always fascinated me is the fact that Geoffrey of Monmouth and sort of medieval British, sort of English and Welsh writers were fascinated by this idea that we are descended from the Trojans. There was a fellow called Brutus who was he was related to Aeneas, who supposedly founded Rome, and that Brutus basically sails across the sea with a load of Trojan refugees and founds Britannia, which is named after him, and he separates his kingdom into three parts, England, Scotland and Wales, which he gives to his three sons, and he founds a city called New Troy, which becomes London, and all this sort of stuff. What's all that about? And the question that puzzles me is, why would you empathise with the Trojans who are losers rather than the Greeks who are the winners?
Because the Trojans are ultimately the winners, because Aeneas, who you mentioned, who is the son of Aphrodite, cousin of the princes of Troy, he escapes Troy. Supposedly he comes to Italy and his descendants found Rome. So the Romans identify themselves with the Trojans. So if you identify yourself with the Trojans, you're also identifying yourself with the Romans.
But why did the Romans do it, though? Why did the Romans... Is it because the Greeks were their rivals and they needed a sort of alternative origin story? They couldn't just take a Greek origin story.
Because the Trojan War and Homer, you know, Homer is the prestige poet and you want a bit of it. And if you can identify yourself with that story, then you're kind of joining in with it. And also it provides a rationale for the Romans to go and conquer Greece.
Right.
Because they can say that they're taking vengeance for the Trojans. And that's something that Mehmet II, the Ottoman who captures Constantinople, he makes great play with this as well. He's saying that he is ruling as the heir of the Trojans, that by capturing Constantinople, he's taking vengeance for the sack of Troy.
And do any modern Turks think this?
Does
Erdogan think he's the heir of Achilles?
No.
The heir of Hector.
Mehmet II had his mother was Greek, so he was kind of plugged into that culture. He was aware of it. I mean, it's much more of a European thing. But in the wake of the collapse of the Roman Empire in early medieval Europe, it's a way for people, as they start to get a sense of their own identity, they look around and by plugging yourself into Greek mythology, Roman history, you're giving yourself a kind of real sense of prestige.
Yeah.
And to say that you're descended from the Trojans, I mean, that, you know, kind of multiplies it. And the great thing about Britannia and Brutus coming to Britain is that Britain was supposedly a land of giants. And I saw in the paper today that Boris Johnson was saying that he's now committed to having a cabinet of giants. So Brutus supposedly fights two giants called Gog and Magog, and it would be great to see them in the cabinet.
Yeah, in place of Gavin Williamson or somebody. You don't think he's a Trojan figure?
I think Gog as Secretary of State for Education would be a lot more fun.
But it's a funny thing, isn't it? How this question about who you empathise with. So. When I was reading it to my son the other night, I said, "Who do you want to win? Who do you?" And he knows the Trojans lose because kind of everybody seems to just know that they lose. And he said, "Oh, well, I really like the Trojans. I like Hector. I know it doesn't end well for him." And I said, "That's funny because I liked Hector when I was, you know, eight. And I wonder whether we think differently than our predecessors might have done because we are programmed. This is a gift to you with your Christianity. Whether we are programmed to cheer for the underdog, we know the Trojans lose, so we kind of, you know, we think they're the good guys, and the Greeks who behave so badly, squabbling about slave girls and crying and behaving in this sort of ludicrous, sort of whingy, snowflakey way. Who empathises with them now?
Well, Achilles is the great hero. He is, you could say, hungry like the wolf.
Very good, Tom.
So we pledged that we get a new romantic lyric in every week, and they're back of the net there. I like.
How long did it take you to work up that one?
So Achilles is the great hero, and he's a great hero because he's basically the best at killing people. And that does seem frightening to us, I think. I mean, Achilles is a frightening figure, but you're right. You know, you mentioned Alexander. Alexander completely models himself on Achilles. And Alexander kills a lot of people as well. And yeah. I think you're right. I think it is essentially...
He's got a view to a kill, Tom.
He's got a view to a kill. I think that our sensibilities are incredibly Christian now. And so we are kind of programmed to identify with those who suffer, those who are the victims, those who become the slaves rather than those who do the slaving.
But the initial consumers of the Iliad, the people who listen to the poets tell and retell these stories, they presumably wouldn't have thought that. They'd have just thought these people are losers, therefore, you know, they got what was coming to them.
Some did, but some didn't. So again, this is a massive theme in Greek tragedy, is the suffering of the losers. And in a way, the kind of, you know, one of the bleakest works of literature ever written is Euripides' Trojan Women, which he's writing against the backdrop of the Peloponnesian War, the great war between Athens and Sparta, which will actually end with the defeat of Athens. But the Athenians are sacking a lot of cities, as the Trojans do. And Euripides gives this portrayal of the queens and the princesses of Troy being rounded up after the sack of the city, about to be led off into slavery. And it's a devastating portrait of what it means to be a victim in a war. And the power of it is precisely that there is no real kind of redemptive quality to it. The key thing that you get from Christianity is the idea that there is a redemptive quality in suffering. So if you counterpoint the sack of Troy in Greek myth to the sack of Jerusalem in the Old Testament, it's terrible, it's devastating, but the conviction that the Jews hold to is that ultimately it's expressive of God's power, and so therefore it is, you know, there is a purpose to it. What you get in Euripides is absolutely bled of any sense of that. This is just you know, terrible stuff happens.
Yeah.
And so it was that kind of Euripidean take was resurrected an awful lot during the Gulf War and the aftermath. So it was almost impossible to go to a theatre and not see a Greek tragedy in which the Greeks were the coalition forces and
Well, as is traditional, we end the podcast with a 10-minute lecture from Tom about Christianity's how it's changed the modern world and how everybody should go and buy his book, which I'm sure you already have. I think we've pretty much run out of time, Tom. But I think there's enough in this for us to come back to Troy and the Trojan War later on in the series, depending on how long the series runs, because there's tons of questions that we actually didn't get to. And I am so sorry to all those people, but we will get to your question one day, possibly. So we'll be back next week with more meanderings down the lanes of history. Please subscribe, rate and review, but obviously only if you like us. It does make all the difference. And please do get in touch with us on Twitter. We are at The Rest History, so no is. Or you can also use @Holland_Tom or @DC Sandbrook. And that's it. Goodbye for now. Thanks for listening.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.